You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello, and welcome to episode 60 of Tea Break Archaeology. I'm Matilda Siebrecht.
And I'm Jessica Van Damme.
And today I am savoring actually a classic, my favorite tea, which is black salted caramel, which is just my, I don't know, it's my go-to. And I feel like I need to buy a bigger tin for it because I'm already nearly out again.
But can't be out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
but anyway. Dangerous.
So yes. And what are you drinking today, Jess?
Well, I got some Thai takeaway for lunch. And so I have a Thai iced tea. It's a little sweet for me, but it's still quite lovely.
That does sound very good. And joining us in our tea break today is a guest. We have a guest again, which is very exciting.
Hooray!
It's been a long time since our last guest, who is Zach Lindsay, who is a specialist in, now, I'm going to say it and then you can correct me, Mayan archaeology. So welcome, Zach.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for having me here. And yeah, so study the Maya. When we talk about the term Maya, we usually don't use the phrase, the adjectival form Mayan. So you'll hear people say Maya archaeology, Maya anthropology. Some folks call themselves Mayanists, which are folks who study the Maya in sort of all their forms. And that might be a better term for what I do, because I also study contemporary Maya people as well.
Interesting. So does Mayan exist as a word, or is it one of those ones that have just kind of fallen into popular culture and people just use it without realizing?
Yeah, it's like a very frustrating little academic debate. We prefer Maya for everything, with one exception that is just there to make your lives hard, I think.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about languages, if we're talking about a language that belongs to the Mayan language family, whenever we're talking about the language family, then we'll talk about Mayan languages. But just to make that even more complicated, there's a language within the Mayan language family that is called Maya. So sometimes when people are talking about languages, they also still talk about Maya. So that's why I usually say if you default to Maya instead of Mayan, you'll be right more often than you're wrong.
Okay. So better to go with Maya and can be corrected by those very few people that are specifically talking.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Okay, that sounds good. I mean, that's like, I was going to say Celtic, but that's the football team, Celtic as well. I mean, because that's actually just the language, but everyone refers to the culture as Celtic culture. And I've done a rant about this, I think, in a previous episode, so I won't go into it today. But
And I always tend to look at it as, you know, if you're not a specialist in this field, like, I don't care. I'm not going to yell at you if you say Mayan. But if you're reading an article in a newspaper or in an academic journal and they start saying Mayan, that is a good sign that they don't necessarily, you should be careful with that information.
Ooh,
it might not
that's
the specialist that they're claiming to be.
Sneaky. I like that.
That's a very good tip. And in terms of the people themselves, like as in contemporary, like modern populations, do they, because I worked a lot with Inuit communities, and of course there's a lot of the, traditionally they used to be called Eskimo, but then now they have, you know, reclaimed the term Inuit and Inuk, and they say they do not like being called Eskimo because it was a derogatory term. Is that the same with Mayan and Maya, or is that less of a political issue?
It is a political issue where folks really don't like the term Mayan. On the other hand, Maya speakers tend to be Spanish second language rather than English second language. So a lot of them don't really have a very strong opinion of it. But I've noticed that Maya folks who do speak English do really tend to prefer Maya. And just like any indigenous groups, right? When we talk about Maya people, that's a term that Western anthropologists have put on them. It's a term we've been using since the 1800s. I'm talking specifically about, well, people who speak Mayan languages, but I'm talking about an area that is southern Mexico and northern Central America. So Guatemala, Belize, and parts of southern Mexico, and also a few northern parts of El Salvador, for example, and Honduras. Those are where we find Maya people who are folks who speak a Mayan language. Now, just like with many indigenous groups, not every person who speaks a Mayan language likes to be referred to as Maya. So there are folks today who prefer being referred to as, for example, Quiche, which is another Mayan language. So rather than calling them Maya, they prefer to be called Quiche.
Okay. Okay, so, well, avoid Mayan, basically, is the end
the
message.
Short rule there, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And thank you very much for joining us on our tea break today. Are you a tea drinker yourself?
So I'm not. I really like coffee. Yeah. I drink too much coffee. Get yelled at by my dentist for it.
To be fair, I get yelled at by my dentist for drinking tea as well because...
Oh, okay. Well, good. I'm glad
black tea. We just can't win.
We come at it, really. I mean, what do they want from us, you know? I mean, gosh. Nice. And is it, because where are you based at the moment?
Yeah, so I'm here in Yucatan, Mexico, the state of Yucatan. And Yucatan Tecos don't drink a lot of tea. They tend to drink a lot of coffee. So it's sort of a social thing. There's lots of very nice coffee drinks down here. There's a type of coffee called café de olla, which is made with cinnamon, super delicious. So lots of little varieties on coffee here. So not just Nescafe or something like that.
Yeah, because of course, when I think of South America, I guess I think of coffee. But is that a general America-wide thing? I don't know. Jess, like from North America or then Central America? Is it also coffee the big one?
I mean, having been a barista for a while, I mean, honestly, the best coffee came out of, I think it was mostly South America. I'm recognizing my geography is terrible.
I feel like we're now going to start
Africa.
A war just from...
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. I can remember what coffee blends were the best at my particular shop, but yes, I always think of warmer, more tropical climates as the coffee climates, and those are the good ones.
Yeah. No, that's
yeah. Fair. Here in Mexico, they grow coffee in Veracruz, which is warmer and tropical, and also in Chiapas. And so those are sort of where the best coffees here in Mexico come from. But unfortunately, a lot of people do drink Nescafe.
The horror.
There's a simplicity
like a weird
there
for it. You know, it's gross, but I love it for some reason. But obviously, I prefer some good Chiapas coffee.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. And yes, it's great to have you on our break. So I feel like we've already learned something because, you know, I will never use the phrase Mayan again. But as well as being familiar with the terminology of Maya archaeology, what is it that you actually do in terms of Maya archaeology?
So again, I live in Mexico and everybody here has like 20 jobs, you know, so it's always a complicated question because I do have a few different things going on. I mostly work in tourism, so I lead tours of the area and I coordinate tour groups in the area. I work with the Maya Exploration Center, which is run by Dr. Ed Barnhart, and he's the archaeologist who mapped Palenque back in the 1990s. So really great knowledge source. And, you know, some tours are sort of these get on a bus full of 40 people and you go to Chichen Itza and they tell you all kinds of silly stuff and then you go back to your hotel and that's it. We tend to be a lot more engaged. We tend to be multi-day tours and big tours where we go to places that folks might not otherwise go and really focus in on the archaeology and the education. Still fun. We still do some swimming and that sort of thing, but mostly focus on archaeology.
Nice. Oh, that's very cool. I work with World Virtual Tours, which is a online sort of touring platform. And I don't do like going out to places. I do like more webinar type things. But a lot of the other guides do, it's especially meant, for example, the older generations who are potentially not so active, not as able to actually go to these places themselves, or people who just financially can't afford to travel and all this kind of stuff. And I'm always so impressed by people who can just go to a site and just, you know, give all this information about it and know everything and be able to answer questions. I'm always just, in awe. But
that feels 13 meters. That always blows my mind when that.
And have you, I guess you learned a lot on the job with that as well.
Yeah, so Ed really likes to, he'll schedule maybe a 6 or 7 day tour and beforehand he'll give me a list of sites and he'll say, have you been to these? And I'll say, yeah, I've been to this one and this one, but I haven't been to this one. And he'll say, well, we'll make sure that you go to the one you haven't been to, too, just so that you get to do something.
So that we can put you on the spot.
Right, exactly, yeah. So there is definitely a lot of research goes into the tours beforehand because he always picks at least one site that I have never been to before.
Yeah, fair enough.
To throw me, I think, but also to keep me interested and so that every trip is something new and exciting for me as well. So the guests see me being excited too.
Yeah. And how did you get into that?
So like you, I also have a background in journalism and communication, and it wasn't making me very much money. I like to
That's crazy. Surprising. Yeah.
Surprising, I know. I often joke that I'm probably the only person you'll ever meet that got into archaeology for the money, because journalism was really not paying very well. And so I went back to school after many years in journalism, and I had been visiting Mexico City, and I went to Teotihuacan in Mexico City, which is an archaeological site that is absolutely massive and really a life-changing experience. I've heard many people go there, and when I tell folks this, a lot of times I get the same, oh, I also went there and suddenly changed my life trajectory. So it's a very impressive site, and going there made me want to understand those people more and the people who had lived there more. So I started focusing more on archaeology than journalism and museums and talking about that sort of thing in my journalism. And slowly I decided to go back to school for anthropology. And at that point, I was living in Austin, Texas, and I was studying with a famous iconographer named Kent Riley. And Kent had gone to school with Linda Sheely, who's also a really famous Mayanist who wrote some of the more accessible books about the Maya. Today, they're a little bit out of date because she was writing in the 80s and 90s, but still very brilliant books. And so he recommended that I meet with one of his peers, who was Dr. Ed Barnhart. And Ed and I had coffee and we enjoyed each other, but we just kind of went our separate ways and didn't really stay in super close touch until I was here in Mexico. And I decided that I was interested in getting into tourism. So I reached out to him and I said, you know, is there any way that I could go on one of your tours with maybe a reduced price? And he said, I can actually do you one better. How about you come on the tour and give a talk on the tour? And we'll
You give the talk?
Right, exactly. And I was like, okay. And that's how I got started. And, you know, we have a really good relationship, he and I. And so I started doing the social media on TikTok and, you know, getting more and more involved. And then folks sometimes come to him and say, you know, I'm going to be in Yucatan for a week, but not during one of your regular tours. Is there anyone there who can show me around? And so he recommends me to them. So I've kind of been growing as an independent guide as well.
Nice. Cool. And do you find that, because I know quite a few people who are academics, you know, they're doing academic research, they have a position at a university, but they also do tour guiding, and those particular people are always adamant. They really try to persuade their students, like in the summer, yes, you need dig experience and yes, you need this, but also you should go and get a job as a tour guide, because that is where you're sort of humbled on the one hand, and then you're also, you know, you really have to learn on the spot. You have to know your stuff. Like, do you also find that it's like, in terms of the research you do versus the physical guiding itself? Like, I guess it's a two-part question. A, like, how do you find the, I guess, ease of it? And B, do you find that it's seen nowadays in kind of a similar light to more academic research? Or is there still a little bit of a sort of stereotype about it, that, you know, it's the easy way out or something like that?
Great question. So, you know, for me, it's really important that we're always working with local guides. Anthropology has the concepts of emic versus etic, right? Emic being like a first person or localized opinion, and etic being an outsider's opinion. Mm. And in my opinion, you can't really understand a culture without both of those things, right? You need the local opinion, and you also need that academic opinion to match, or at least maybe not be in agreement, but at least have both those perspectives to consult with. So that's one of the reasons that I think it's really essential to work with local guides. But the other reason is the fact that Maya people today still live in these areas. These are their places. They're their, in a sense, they're their sites. And sometimes, in fact, Maya people still go to those sites to worship. And so to me, it's really important to have a local voice there with us who is able to talk to cultural issues that, I mean, I've been in this area for a long time. I know the culture pretty well, but I didn't grow up in a Maya-style house. And so, you know, getting those local opinions is really important. Yeah. Not only that, but we are outsiders in someone else's house, essentially. So the more money that we can be throwing towards local voices is obviously better.
Yeah, nice. Well, I think we'll probably talk a little bit more about that in the next episode. But for now, let's take a very quick break to top up our tea, and we will be right back. Welcome back, everyone. I hope your teacup is fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So I didn't invite Zach to come and join me on this tea break today just to chat about tour guides and the etymology of the word Maya. We also wanted to discuss something very specific that Zach actually introduced me to. I didn't even realize it was a concept in like archaeological research, but the concept of cute, which is... I mean, ironically, it's so cute. Like, that is a concept. So what is cute as a concept in archaeology?
Yeah, so cute is an aesthetic principle. And when we look at art, we can divide art into aesthetic, different aesthetics. Of course, any kind of grouping of pottery or ceramics, as I'm sure you all know, is inefficient, right? It's modern. Mm. No. Most artists, I'm sure there are exceptions to this, but most artists don't sit down and say, I want to do something cute. They say, I'm going to draw, you know, X, and I want it to give Y emotion. And in some cases, the aesthetic that then falls into is cute, right? A lot of times when people think about art and they think about aesthetics, they immediately go to the sublime, right? So the sublime is art that just overawes you, overwhelms you with emotion. And usually that emotion is an intense one that is, you know, I don't want to say negative, but extreme, right? And so we think of The Scream, for example, is a sort of classic example of the sublime, or Saturn devouring his son. When we see these images for the first time, a lot of times there's a moment of shock, right? They're so intense that we are shocked. And many times, especially people who are outside of the field of art history, a lot of times people think that is art, that art has to be sublime in order to be considered, quote, art. Mm-hmm. But there are, of course, a lot of other aesthetic categories. Art serves different purposes in different contexts. And so cute is an aesthetic category. And that means that it is something that we can define. There are definitions of cute that are specific, even though a lot of times when we think of cute, we tend to think of this sort of very fuzzy image of maybe like a general happy, cute animal or something like that. But when we're talking about art, cute is something that we can define. And there are actually scholars who study the cute as an aesthetic category. Yeah, so cute is an aesthetic category. And when we use it in the sense of the cute, we're talking about something pretty specific that does have a purpose, that is not just sort of for the sake of being cute, right? Cute serves a purpose. And so...
Well, is it so immediate? Well, obviously, immediately when I think of cute, I have my new little puppy here next to me, and she is the epitome of cute. But I was thinking of art forms that, you know, produce emotion that you were just talking about. And when I think of that in regards to cute, I think of not a physical art piece, but do you know those like videos of, you know, soldiers returning from war and their dog seeing them for the first time, or like people getting a puppy and things like that. And it's those videos that just immediately want you to start crying. Is it that kind of emotion that's sort of linked with that cute aesthetic?
Yeah, so one of the main scholars of the cute today is a guy named Josh Dale, and he has a quote. He says, it's in our nature to nurture, right? And when we talk about cuteness, he's talking about sort of this invitation to engage in social behaviors. So cuteness is really an appeal. It's a way of being open and encouraging openness. So companionship, cooperative action, communication through emotional reactivity. These are all sort of things that Josh Dale focuses on when he talks about the cute. And when you're talking about those videos where you see a person reunited with their dog or that sort of thing, you have that, you are drawn into it. There's a cooperation or companionship that you now share with the person in the video. So that is 100% an example of cute. It's not really, in this case, maybe not. I mean, is a TikTok video art? I'm sure that's like a total.
We're going to get into a whole other debate.
Right, yeah. but in a sense, it's certainly the aesthetic of cute being tapped.
Yeah. And I mean, we're focusing on objects in this particular podcast, on material culture. Is there a particular kind of Maya material culture object or type of object? Or, I mean, I was thinking initially of like iconography, I guess, as that was what immediately came to mind in my head. But is there anything else that is specifically about that aesthetic, that cute aesthetic, that is a nice example of that?
With the Maya, not so much. But I study Mesoamerica in general, which is the whole area of pretty much northern Mexico, the deserts of northern Mexico, down into northern Central America. And so, you know, that area also includes cultures like the Mexica, who are more commonly known as the Aztecs, Zapotecs, Mixtecs, these people. And one of the most famous ones are what are called the Colima dogs. You might have even seen pictures of these, and I can definitely share some to show your
listeners later on.
Colima dogs are these really, they look a little bit like Chihuahuas. They're a species that probably, pardon me, not a species, but a breed that probably eventually became what we know as Chihuahuas today. And they tend to be a little bit fat and tiny and petite. And they oftentimes have a little bit of a smile on their face, and these objects don't have a lot of detail on them. And interestingly enough, if we look at, for example, Preston Blair, he was an animator for Walt Disney who spent a lot of time thinking about what cute is. And in one of his books, he basically creates a list of what how to make something cute. And those Colima dogs tick off pretty much every one of his check marks, right? Again, so they have a useful appearance to them. They look like puppies. They're proportioned like puppies. They're round. They don't have a lot of detail. Their features are exaggerated. The features that they do have are exaggerated. So these are all things that are sort of classifiably cute. And so I mentioned, you know, the Maya don't really have a lot of cute objects. There are a few objects that I would classify as cute, but in other cultures near them, there are more objects that are classifiable as cute. And one of the things that I get into with people is that sometimes people find it very hard to say, well, how can I measure whether something is cute or not? And I did actually measure the head shapes of figurines from Veracruz, which is on the coast, to figurines of in the Maya area of Yucatan. And statistically, there is a difference in the head shapes, and the Maya head shapes tend to be more elongated, and the Veracruz head shapes tend to be rounder, and that's to the point where Maya head in ceramic tends to be more elongated than actual human heads, and Veracruz figurines tend to be more rounded than actual human heads. Now, as Preston Blair would say, round is cute. So
okay.
You can actually measure the statistical significance of the cute, right? These objects were made round, made with limited details. And of course, you might say, well, maybe the ceramicist just couldn't do anything different than that. But we have examples of Veracruz figurines that do have a lot of detail. There's a figure of an old man who has just absolutely covered in wrinkles, and his teeth are, he's missing some teeth, and he's definitely not cute. So it's not that the artistic style was insufficient to portray other things. It appears that it was a deliberate choice.
Interesting. Oh,
I have a question. So you said they were the Colima dogs. Are these little figures of dogs, or are they like engraved on like a ceramic, or are they depicted on like a wall art, or are they depicted in a lot of different formats?
Yeah, they're mostly figurines. So we see them.
Okay.
And they, unfortunately, a lot of them are from looted context, so we don't always know exactly where they came from, but it does seem like many of them came from burials. And
interesting.
Today, even still among some Mesoamerican cultures, dogs escort you through the trials of the underworld. So it's believed that these dogs, the Colima dogs, had some sort of role in escorting people through the challenges of the underworld.
Which would then make sense if they're trying to make them kind of cute, because, you know, if they're supposed to be taking you to the underworld, you don't want to be scared like at that particular moment. You want to be, you know, feeling a little happy and a little emotional, I guess, in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the reasons that cute art has a role in society at all, because it helps to renegotiate relationships with sort of these big topics like death. Very common today to see images of like cartoon. I'm sure that everyone here has seen at least one cartoony version of the Grim Reaper or something like that, right? And he's made cute in a way that sort of disarms him, right? Usually when a character like the Grim Reaper is made cute, maybe he's still very serious, but sort of silly things are happening around him. And so the fright of death becomes disarmed in a way. Hmm. And that's definitely one of the things that he seems to do in contemporary art and also seems to have done in ancient art.
Interesting.
I immediately pictured death from Terry Pratchett's Discworld.
I mean, I'm glad I'm not the one that brought him up because I bring him up every single time.
I'm here now. I can come in with the Terry Pratchett references.
I knew there was a reason I chose you as my co-host.
With Pinky. With Pinky.
And the little, the death of rats as well, which is also like a cutified death of rat. Yeah. Well, I think we're going to get probably into more into this topic in the next episode, but unfortunately, we're probably running out of time a little bit on this particular tea break. But don't worry, if you want to find out more about Cute and how on earth that relates to archaeology and how we interpret archaeology, there'll be another episode coming up in 2 weeks where we are going to be chatting further with Zach all about his work in that respect. I hope that you enjoyed this tea break. If you did, please do like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode or about Zach's work, you can find all of the links and contact information in the show notes. Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.